This is Car Expert.
The Golf is just a really nice, really planted car, and the Kia is more raw and more engaging.
The WRX, I don't know if it's quite as aspirational a purchase as it once was.
It literally looks like RoboCop that can carry eight people.
Hello, my name's Mandy Turner. G'day, Paul Marrick.
Hey, Mandy, how are you?
Very well, and hello, William Stopford.
Hey, Mandy.
We're loving that jumper, by the way. Would you call it a bad, like, I don't want to put you down, but it's like, you know, when you said there's bad Christmas jumpers that you see.
Yeah, no, I know. I get exactly what you mean. Paul made fun of me before. It's very warm. I also have it in orange, but for those who are listening at home or in the car, it's like this like zip up kind of sweater, and it's got like kind of striping across it. It's got this very Christmassy feel. The temperature up here, it was getting really warm and we're like spring has sprung, and then this cold, dusty front blew in and messed with my allergies and dropped the temperature quite a bit. So I'm wearing this lovely warm sweater jumper.
It suits you very well.
Oh, thank you.
I've got to say. We are actually going to go into the biggest car news of the week now. And Paul, get the tissues out for every car enthusiast in Australia, the Nissan GTR. Its reign in Australia has ended.
That's it. We got an email from Nissan saying, hey, we're revealing the new GTR. Here's a live stream link. We watched it and it was kind of the same GTR, just with some very basic changes. But then the whammy that followed straight after that was that by November this year, the GTR will be dead in Australia. And that is because of these side impact laws that are basically being rolled out across Europe. We're accepting those changes here in Australia. And there's a number of models that are going to be affected by this. We mentioned earlier that a whole stack of Lexus vehicles, including the new IS that they literally only just launched, will not be allowed to be sold, and they're basically being withdrawn from sale as well. Commercial vehicles will run into the same fate next year. So it is a really sort of interesting thing. The GTR, you know, I joke about its age, but I had the chance to drive the Nismo in Germany. When was it? 2019. It feels like last year, but it was actually a lot longer than that. And that thing is still an absolute supercar killing missile. And it's a platform that's now, you know, a decade old or however long it is. So, yeah, despite the age of the car, it is still a really, really commendable package.
You a bit sad, Will?
Yeah, I'm a bit sad. It's Godzilla was defeated not by Mothra, but by side impact regulations. but it's been around for so long. And at least we're getting these very, very mild updates before it goes. Couple of really cool colors. The Japanese press photos show this gorgeous, like, emerald green interior and this weird new exterior color that's, I think, Midnight Purple and Millennium Jade are the two colors they're going to be offering in this updated model. Look, it's a gorgeous car. I still haven't had a chance to drive one. Looks like there won't be one on press fleet anytime soon, so I'll have to experience that some other way.
Can you sum up just really quickly, Paul, what these new rules are? Because we have now seen that the Alpine is a victim of it as well.
Yeah, the side impact regulations, they seem to be affecting cars on older platforms, and these are changes to the Australian design rule, and it really is strange to me it's strange to me that everyone is being caught off guard by this, and it's ADR 85 is the official name for it, and they're basically strict new rules with regards to side impacts, and cars need to be able to meet them from this year, commercial vehicles from next year. So, it is disappointing, and I don't know, we'll see what else comes out of this. We're checking around all the manufacturers now to see which other surprises are going to come out of the woodworks, including the 70 series. That's currently not eligible to be on sale, so they need to make some changes to that before this time next year for it to stay on sale in Australia.
And this is a regulation that was announced about like 5 years ago.
Yeah.
It is a case where Australia has actually been taking the lead on this regulation. So a lot of these cars that are being discontinued here, they're going to continue to be able to be sold in other markets for a period of time. But, you know, when you've got a situation like particularly with the Alpine, we're already such a tiny market and we're an even tinier market for Alpine products. So why a company, there's no incentive for a company to invest in potentially costly structural changes to make a car compliant with here. So they can just wait it out until finally they're forced to upgrade it for higher volume markets. So, it's we've known about this regulation for a while, but it's still just surprising that it's just out of the blue. Companies just seem to be reacting to it in discontinuing vehicles rather than actually upgrading them.
Yeah, absolutely. Will, the 2022 Subaru WRX has been revealed. I don't know how I feel about this. What do you think?
We've heard this story before, haven't we? Concept car gets released. Oh, it looks pretty all right. Here's hoping Subaru will make the production version look the same. And they didn't really, did they? So the images got dropped late last week. I guess 2 weeks ago, if you're listening now, of the new WRX. And I think the thing that has really caught everybody's attention right away are the chunky black plastic wheel arch extensions.
Don't need cladding on a Rex.
What
Why?
The hell? I don't know what they were going
because
for
Robbie.
There. Well, you know, it's just, I was saying this to Alpaz the other day, it just feels like Subaru copped so much flack for some of their wackier design choices back in the early 2000s that since then they've been really, really, really cautious and really conservative. And now they're like, oh, let's try and be a little bit wild. What about wheel arch extensions? Like, you know, it's just this, because the rest of the car is so completely forgettable and anonymous. It just kind of looks like every other Subaru on sale. And then you just got these weird, but I don't want to talk too much about plastic wheel arch extensions. Let's actually talk what's under the bonnet. So it's now been upgraded to a turbocharged 2.4-liter four-cylinder engine. So that's up 400 cc's on the outgoing car, but only up 5 kilowatts of power. So a lot more displacement for really not much more power. So it's 202 kilowatts at 5,600 RPM. Peak torque is actually unchanged at 350 newton meters. But it comes on between 2,000 and 5,200 RPM. So it's available 400 RPM earlier and hangs around 200 RPM longer. So not really massive changes despite a larger engine under the bonnet. There is still a CVT in it, which continues to just astonish me. But there is still, fortunately, a 6-speed manual. The CVT does at least have 8 pre-programmed steps to mimic a traditional auto. You know what feels like a traditional auto? A traditional auto. So Subaru, take notes.
Yeah.
So power is sent to all four wheels, as you would expect, and there's an active torque vectoring system. Subaru hasn't, revealed the new STI yet. Who knows what strange plastic they will have stuck on that. But ultimately, if you read the comments, and I don't know if Subaru is reading the comments, but everyone's like, oh no, various different kind of disgusted emojis. And I just want to stress it. It's not ugly. It's just a combination of bland and awkward. And it's kind of, I feel like Subaru is kind of losing its momentum with the WRX, because you remember there was that time, there was a time for quite a while where it was highly sought after at that end of the market. The performance it offered, the dynamics, it was a benchmark. And now I feel like, you know, the market seems to have more of gravitated towards like Golf GTI, i30N, you know, and at the higher end, things like your A-Class AMG models. And the WRX, I don't know if it's quite as aspirational a purchase as it once was. What do you guys think?
No, definitely not. But I don't know. I kind of feel like they're flogging a dead horse here. They should have really just wrapped it up with the last one and just sort of let it die gracefully. I mean, if you're not even going to bump up the torque, I mean, what's the point? I don't know.
If it's, you so go to all of the effort of delineate, like separating the WRX from the core Impreza line, you'd think that maybe you'd then take the WRX in like an exciting, fresh, you know, design direction and make it a very unique bespoke model. This, for all intents and purposes, while it doesn't look like an Impreza, it looks like it could be an Impreza. And it just strikes me as just a waste of money. Like just get an Impreza and just give it the WRX treatment. You know, that would probably be cheaper for Subaru. I don't know what the hell they're thinking.
There you go. Well said, Will. Paul, the 2022 Toyota RAV4 has been revealed. What has changed from last year, or this year, I should say?
Well, apparently you won't need to wait 12 months for this one because that's what we're being told at the moment. If you go to a Toyota dealer, you're going to have to wait for a RAV4. So Toyota put out a press release a couple of months ago saying, hey, if you want to buy one, we would highly recommend waiting for the 2022 because that will be available before your 2021 is available, which makes no sense to me. But anyway, so now we've finally – and the other thing is with that press release, they had no images of the car, which I thought was completely bizarre. So now we've seen images of the 2022, and I'll tell you what, it actually really sort of just refines the design. So you've got a new set of LED headlights. We're getting LED fog lights for Australia, LED interior treatment. You've got some cooled seats getting added to the range, some additions to the safety features. It really is just sort of refining what is already an impressive package. It's the RAV4 Hybrid is such a sensational car that I don't think they really needed to change all that much. So I'm excited for this to finally arrive. But just like all new cars on the market today, there are just huge waits and lots of delays for these things.
So what happens if you've got a 2021 coming and it's all of a sudden, oh, hang on, I can get the 22 earlier. Can you do that? Can you swap?
Well, that was my understanding, that you could elect to take the 2022, but you needed to cancel your order for the 2021. I remember there was something along those lines. So I think now you just need to accept that you just go for the 2022 instead, or if you're, you know, insist on the 2021, they must be making them in parallel for the moment or something. I really don't understand how the system works.
Interesting. And lastly, Will, the 2022 Mazda CX-5 is coming to Australia, which is probably no surprise, is it? It's a pretty good seller here.
Yeah, so we were talking about Australia's best-selling midsize SUV with very minor updates. Now we're talking about Australia's second best-selling midsize SUV with very minor updates. look, the updates to the CX-5 are virtually on the same scale as the RAV4 update. But Mazda's done something a little bit different this time around. They're trying to more visually distinguish models in the range. So the GTSP is going to get more prominent gloss black detailing. The Acura is going to get body colored cladding around the wheel arches to make it look more luxurious. I find that doesn't really work with SUVs because then it just makes them look a bit kind of overly tall, but you know. The Touring actually is getting a pretty handsome off-road style kind of cladding on the arches and doors, and lime green grille accents, which is a bit strange. Oh. But so I've seen the photos and it kind of works. There's a new paint color. Mazda says they have actually revised the suspension and given it a stiffer structure. But they haven't announced any changes to the engines. I suspect they probably won't make any changes to the engines. I think, you know, odds are Mazda's spoken about its new large architecture that's coming, which will be a rear/all-wheel drive architecture. It's going to use inline 6 petrol and diesel engines. It's going to have the capacity for both mild and plug-in hybrids. And they have basically said that for CX-5 and above, you know, on the large platform, they're going to have models. So while I don't think that they're going to replace the CX-5 directly with another midsize SUV with much more premium aspirations, as much as Mazda's trying to push its kind of self a little bit upmarket, I suspect that we'll see something like a CX-50 or something like that come along on that architecture. And the CX-5, you know, they've just given it an update, so it's probably got some life left in it yet. The CX-5 is fundamentally a good SUV. Look, I really like the way the CX-5 drives, and it's continued to be such a popular model in Australia because we love Mazda like a disproportionate amount compared to other markets. Mm-hmm. We're Mazda mad here, mad as. The CX-5.
Thanks for your time, Will. We'll get you to wrap up now as well. Oh, that was terrible.
Oh, gosh. I thought if I just did it subtly, you wouldn't notice how lame it was. But look, the CX-5's got some life left in it yet, so it'll be very interesting to get behind the wheel of the updated CX-5 and the updated RAV4 next year.
Yeah, for sure. That wraps up this week's news. Head to Car Expert if you'd like to read more. How's this for a comparison? The Volkswagen Golf R-Line and the Kia Cerato GT. I bet you had fun with this one, Scott Colley.
This one was a good, fun comparison, Mandy. Often we put really practical cars side by side, like vans or seven-seat SUVs, but occasionally we get a couple of sporty cars through, and I was the one lucky enough to drive these.
What's the R-Line got that the others don't?
So the R-Line is like the halfway house between a normal Golf and a Golf GTI or a Golf R. It's got a sportier exterior, so it rides on unique wheels. It's got a really cool stylized R badge in the grille. It rides 15 mil lower than the Golf Life, and it also has an interior design with fake carbon fiber and bucket-style seats with some Alcantara and some tartan trim. So it's essentially the nicest Golf you can buy without paying for a GTI, but it's also meant to look a little bit sportier and give those people who I think want a Golf R but can't afford a Golf R some way to kind of give the illusion of having one.
Can they afford this though?
Well, they'd have to be doing all right because it's not cheap. The Serato GT is just over $35,000 drive away. It's $35,290, and then you can put premium paint on it for $520, which takes it to $35,810 drive away. That includes absolutely everything you can get: sunroof, leather, heated and ventilated seats, the full works. The V-Dub is $37,450 before on-road costs. You can then pay $1,500 to get the Vision package, which gets you a head-up display and a more powerful sound system, and our tester had, and another $1,800 on top of that for a panoramic sunroof, and then up to $900 for paint. So our test car was just under $40,000. It was $39,250 before on-road costs. And if you look at the Volkswagen stock checker to see what it's going for drive away, there are some cars that are similarly specced. They didn't have the Vision package, but they did have the panoramic sunroof for $46,500 drive away, which is, for all intents and purposes, $10,000 more than the Kia.
That is insane.
That's what's GTI money? That's pretty close.
So GTI money is now about $65,000 drive away. It starts at just over $50,000. You should add an option pack to it to make it, you know, feel like a GTI actually should. And at that point, you're looking at $65,000 on the road. So we know the new Golf isn't cheap. This R-Line is actually cheaper than its equivalent in the old range, although options and that sort of thing can play around with that. But yeah, the reason we're doing this comparison isn't because these cars match up perfectly on price, but it's because they take very different approaches to kind of the same thing. And that's, how do I go from something that's not even remotely sporty to something a little bit more interesting without paying $65,000 for a Golf GTI or, you know, $60,000 on the road for a Hyundai i30N.
What's under the bonnet of both of them? I know it's an engine, but like, what size?
You're very good at this, Mandy.
We've been doing this podcast together for too long, Mandy, because the words were almost out of my mouth when you said, I know it's an engine. I was just about to say an engine. There would have been a time where it would have been really strange for Kia to have the more powerful engine and a dual clutch transmission, but the Serato has got a 1.6-litre turbocharged petrol four-cylinder engine, and it is the more powerful car of the two here. It also has a 7-speed dual-clutch transmission, where the Volkswagen has now made the switch for 2021, 2022 to a torque converter. So the Kia's got 150 kilowatts and 265 newton metres. The Golf has 110 kilowatts and 250 newton metres. In the real world, the gap between them isn't actually as big as maybe it sounds on paper, but there's no doubt the Kia is the sportier of the two cars.
Which one does the interior better?
It depends on who you ask. And I know that's a cop-out of an answer, but Will, I know you've driven the Golf. Paul, I don't know if you've actually driven a new Golf yet.
Yes, I have briefly, yep.
When you sit in the Golf 8, it just feels like a concept car compared to the Golf 7, the 6, and the 5. And they're all sort of, they were all iterations on the same theme. The new one throws out the rule book. And the positive to that is that it just looks awesome. It's like a cut price Mercedes A-Class with two big screens, hardly any buttons, and it's just super clean. The downside to that is that it's a bit of a pain in the ass to use. If you want to change the fan speed, for example, and I know that some people are big fans of auto climate control, but I like to fiddle with it constantly. You've got to press a button on the dashboard and then go into a touchscreen menu and then press the screen to change the fan. And that means that whatever was on the screen goes away. It means there's more time with your eyes off the road. And it also means that every single time you want to do that, you're putting a fingerprint on the gloss back dash and then you're putting a fingerprint on the touchscreen. The old Golf didn't look nearly as exciting, but it had a really easy little wheel down on the dashboard and you would just twist it because you knew where it was and you didn't even have to think about it. So although it looks really slick, there are some ways in which the new Golf is a step backwards from the old one because it just makes what should be really simple things harder. It also really annoys me that if you press the climate control sync button, which is in a menu, and then you turn the car off, it automatically unsyncs the climate control next time. So if I'm the driver and I turn the climate down, the passenger doesn't come with me unless I manually go back into that menu. It sounds like a really small thing, but if you're a bit of a weirdo like I am, it'll annoy you too.
Yeah, I get that. What
the Golf is really good at is the fundamentals of how you sit and how you look out of the car. The driving position is awesome for tall drivers. You sit right on the floor. You can go a long way back and the steering wheel comes to exactly the right spot. For all that's really modern and sort of eye-catching about it, it does the boring stuff really well. And you could happily drive that Golf R line from Melbourne to Sydney when the borders open at some point eventually and not feel the need to get out and stretch your legs because it just is really comfortable. The Kia counters that by offering more equipment as standard. It's got a sunroof, heated and ventilated seats that are electrically powered. It's got just lots of stuff that on a spec sheet looks really flash. And it's also more conventional. So the second you sit in the Kia, you know exactly how to do everything. And the climate controls have got a little binnacle of their own. The climate controls have got a little display and controls of their own. The infotainment screen's got a whole lot of shortcut buttons on the side of it, although it still has its quirks as well. But you sit in the Kia and you just go, this is just easy. It just feels natural. Where the Kia doesn't match the Golf is in space. In the back, it's not quite as comfortable. But also in the front with that sunroof and the way the seats are all set up, the headroom's not great for taller drivers and the Kia just doesn't feel as sporty. You sit a little bit high up on top of it and it kind of feels like a cheap car that's been dressed up with some expensive sporty stuff, where the Golf just fundamentally feels more expensive and accommodating to start with.
So I suppose we should get to the most important part. How do they drive?
They drive well. Thank you for having me on.
Good. Okay, see you, bye.
So the Kia is definitely the sportier of the two cars. And from the second you turn it on, it makes more noise, steering's got more weight to it, and the ride is a bit harsher. Kia's not really known for doing like focused driver's cars, but the Cerato GT feels really, really purposeful. It feels like it's like on the warmer end of warm hatch from the second you turn the wheel for the first time. And that's really cool for the price because I can't think of anything, even the Hyundai i30 N line, that has that same sense of being a bit of a driver's car for the same money. It definitely feels keener than the Golf when you flick it into a corner. It feels awesome, like it's up on its toes. And part of that's down to the way the suspension's set up. Part of it's down to the fact that Kia puts it on decent tyres. But the downside to that is that it always is quite firm and busy. And over potholes and city bumps and that sort of thing, it's just always moving up and down a little bit. It's not uncomfortable. It's not going to ruin your day. But it's also something that you really want to know getting into it, because if you are buying this just after the most luxurious Kia Cerato you can get, this isn't going to do that job for you. It's designed to feel sporty, and that really comes through in the way it rides. The Golf drives exactly like you would expect of a Golf, and I know that's a boring thing to say, but this Golf 8 is the biggest step that Volkswagen's made in a long time in the Golf, because the Golf 6 was a mildly evolved Golf 5 and the Golf 7 was an evolved Golf 6. But it's still a Golf. In Australia, it's got a carryover engine, so it's got the same sort of feeling of really smooth, effortless torque. The steering feels roundly the same as it was in the last Golf, which means it really nicely balances feeling sporty and direct with, you know, being light and easy to twirl in the city, so you can park easily with just your little pinky finger if you want to. And it's quiet and refined and feels like a bigger car when you're going quickly on the highway. So the biggest thing that stands out with the Golf is actually its transmission. We're really used to Volkswagen stuff having dual clutch transmissions, and I know how you feel about those, Paul. I know you're not a fan of them.
I'm not a fan of bad ones.
The 8-speed auto in the Golf kind of changes its character a little bit. It doesn't feel nearly as snappy or as sharp when you're moving, and you put your foot down and it kind of slurs a little bit from gear to gear in normal mode, which if you're used to the sporty feeling of an older Golf will be a bit strange. But the trade-off is it just feels really conventional in the city in a way that the old one never did. It creeps really naturally off the mark. It doesn't have that sort of awkward moment of hesitation that even the best newest Volkswagen DSGs in their low-powered engines did. So it definitely just feels like a Golf that's slightly smoother and slightly more normal than the old Golf. It's not as sporty as the Kia. It rides a little bit more firmly than the normal Golf, and it sits a little bit lower, which is something that having now driven the normal Golf that's in the garage this week, actually, for me, sort of stands out. It feels a little bit more than a normal Golf, but it strikes a really good balance between being comfortable every day and still feeling a little bit sporty. Whether or not it's going to be sporty enough for someone who's looking at the Kia, I'm not sure, because going back to back between them, the Golf is just a really nice, really planted car. And I'm sure that if you were to take the Volkswagen badge off and slot an Audi badge onto the steering wheel, you could easily convince people that it's an A3. It just drives with that really smooth German kind of polish. But the Kia is more raw and more engaging, and it's just more fun. It's a really cool little sports hatch, and it kind of it makes the Golf feel a little bit dull sometimes.
Fair enough. I suppose it sounds like would have been a hard one to decide who got the win. Have you decided yet?
It was a difficult one. In the end, the Cerato won the comparison, and that's just down to the price.
Really?
The Golf is a better car, I think. It's more polished. It's more rounded, more comfortable to drive. But the Kia is so much car for your money, and that's still the case even in 2021, 2022, when it's priced just under $36,000 drive away. I actually first drove the Cerato GT about 3 years ago, and it was a $32,000 car drive away, which is even more crazy. But even with this price rise, even with this update that Kia's given it, it just represents really good value, and I can understand why you would buy the Golf, but for me, it's really hard to look past the Kia for the amount of fun you get for your money.
Question for you, Scott. I think we've all driven Hyundai i30s by now, but if you were in the market, Cerato GT or i30 N-line sedan? Because I've just spent a little bit of time in an i30 N-line sedan and really enjoyed it. I haven't had time to behind the wheel of a Cerato GT yet, so I'm curious to hear your thoughts.
I haven't driven the N-line sedan. I've driven the hatchback. Hyundai definitely does a better job balancing ride comfort with handling. The i30 N-line, from my memory, definitely doesn't feel as harsh as the Kia, and that's obviously something that's going to stand out if you drive it every day. I just think for me, the thing with the Kia is the value it represents. To get all of the equipment from the Cerato GT in an i30 N-line, you've got to look at the premium. And you're just looking at a more expensive car with the same running gear. So I think the thing with the Kia is that, for one, it's just one spec. What you see is what you get besides the color. But to get the same level of equipment and the same drivetrain in the Hyundai, you just need to pay more. And realistically, I can understand, again, why you would want that, something a little bit more refined and grown up. And I quite like the way the i30 sedan looks. But realistically, it's really hard to go past that Kia for just the amount of performance it offers for the price, even compared to Hyundai's own bargains.
There you go. A great sum up there. That comparison will be live at carexpert.com.au by the time you hear this podcast. Scott Colley, thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
We've touched on the brand new Hyundai People Mover, the Staria, a few times over the past weeks. But now we can talk to someone who has driven it. That man is you, Paul. I still can't believe this thing is a production car and not a concept.
Yeah, I completely agree. I was a huge fan of RoboCop growing up, and I think this really nails the RoboCop brief on car design. It literally looks like RoboCop that can carry 8 people. It's just the weirdest thing. The Staria. Look, in person, it actually looks a whole lot better than the pictures. So I know the pictures are alarming to some people, but in person, it really has a vibe to it. It is really characterful, I think is the way to put it. So the Staria price range starts at just under $50,000 and goes all the way up to a little over 65 grand for the top spec Highlander diesel, which is the one that we drove. The diesel is exclusively available with all-wheel drive. We had the chance, we're doing a lot of testing at the moment at the former Holden Proving Ground, which is now owned by VinFast. So there's a really great network of roads there where we can do low and high-speed testing, and I've got to tell you that the Staria for a people mover is surprisingly good at higher speeds. It has excellent body control. Even though it doesn't have an Australian ride and handling tune, the tune that comes out of Korea is really good, and Hyundai was involved in the early process of selecting settings for the vehicle. So we're sort of really impressed with the way it rides and handles. The engine, it feels a little bit underdone, so it's a similar engine to the one you'll find in the Carnival, but it is less powerful and offers less torque, and as a result of that, the 2.3-ish ton Vehicle feels a little sluggish at times. I think we did an 11-second 0 to 100 just with one person in the car. So you can imagine if you load it up with passengers, it's going to feel positively slow. The all-wheel drive system will add sort of extra weight to the package as well. So that is one thing to keep in mind. A fair bit of road noise as well from the tyres. And in addition to that, the diesel is really noisy at low speeds too. So it's not really a quiet environment to sort of be in while you're sort of trucking along, which is just a little bit disappointing, I reckon.
So this is quite a bit larger than a Kia Carnival, but is it more practical?
No. So this is the thing that surprised me. So yes, it is larger than a Carnival. Inside it feels enormous. Like the glass house is massive. There's just loads and loads of headroom. But with the Carnival, if you crack the boot open, you have a far more practical storage area. So you do have about 800 litres available behind the third row in the Staria, which is excellent. But unlike the Carnival, you don't get the subfloor storage. So with the Carnival, you can drop the third row into the floor and have virtually a flat storage space. And that's because with the Carnival, the spare tire is located under the passenger compartment as opposed to at the rear of the vehicle. So Staria has its spare tire at the rear of the vehicle. And as a result of that, you have a load space that's okay, but the third row, for example, it just the backrests just fold. And then you just have a space that just really isn't entirely practical for loading heaps of things in. So you do have plenty of leg room. The second row slides forwards and backwards, and so does the third row. But ultimately, I think the interior is a little let down in terms of the way that it's laid out. I do like the fact that you have a passenger view feature. It's like a CCTV camera built into the roof that allows you to spy on the kids and figure out who's punching who and all that sort of stuff. So that side of things is good. But yeah, just a little bit sort of disappointed with that practicality.
So styling aside, and I'm not sure how many people who are buying a people mover are really making that their number one priority, but styling aside, why would you choose a Staria over a Carnival?
You know what? I don't know. One of my followers on Instagram got in touch with me and he said that he's part of the Jewish community and he said they're going to eat up the Staria if it's priced right. And I thought that's really interesting. And I said, well, what makes it appealing? And he said it's the amount of people you can fit inside, but also the luggage space. So I get that point of view, and I think that's why people are buying it over a Carnival. But ultimately, even stuff like I can't see the Speedo or the digital readout because the steering wheel sits right in my line of sight with the digital cluster. And as a result of that, well, I can drop the steering wheel, but then I can't turn because my hands hit my knees. So it is just the most pointless setup in the world. And I think it is just I have this freakish body sort of arrangement. But ultimately, if you're not building cars that what I think is a sort of fairly average human can actually drive, you're really doing that design process wrong. So, look, I enjoyed the Staria. I just didn't love it. And there are some things there that they really need to work on, especially when the Carnival, the top spec, is within hundreds of dollars of this. You would just get a Carnival instead. It just really makes no sense to go and buy the Staria.
I guess the one thing that the Staria does offer is all-wheel drive at this price point, because I'm pretty sure if you want to have an all-wheel drive people mover, you've got to look up towards some of the pricier Volkswagen vans, because I know the Carnival doesn't have.
Yep, that's a really good point. And it shares a platform with Santa Fe, which means we'll probably get hybrid at some point. But the all-wheel drive is a really good point. You can also lock it into they've got a four-wheel drive lock mode that effectively locks a center differential. So that is useful, and you certainly can't do that with a Carnival. So that is probably the only reason you would pick this over a Carnival if that was some feature that you desperately needed.
And Hyundai did suggest that they were going to be developing a hydrogen-powered Staria at some point, if I recall correctly. So that would be futuristic technology for a futuristic-looking car.
Yeah, exactly. It just needs to have like guns that come out of it in case you have any bad people around that you need to sort out.
Proper RoboCop edition, they should call it. Which car expert rating did you give it, Paul?
So we gave it this was a tricky one. So the overall rating is an 8.2. It sort of really excels in some areas but falls down in others. So, it is a high rating because I am sort of super critical of some of these parts. But, I think it could be higher still. I think we gave the Carnival around an 8.7.
Okay. That review, if you would like to read it more in depth, you can head to carexpert.com.au. The Havel H2 is no longer, but in its place is the Jolyon, a small-sized SUV. James Wong, you've spent some time with this car. Hello to you.
Hello. Hello, everyone.
Was it now a jolly time?
Do you know what? I thought it was a jollier time than I thought it was going to be. I
will, oh, good.
I will,
yeah. Yeah. No. So we had the top spec one, which is called the Ultra. Paul did a really great video review on it, which is live on our YouTube channel and also embedded in the written review. And you know, I'll be honest, I've been a bit skeptical of some of the Chinese brands for a little while. I've been in some MG product, come away, you know, like thinking that they're getting there, but they're not quite there yet. And when, you know, Havel's previous product was easily quite a bit far behind, especially things like the H2, like that thing is and was pretty rubbish. So when they brought out the Jolion and they've got it so sharply priced and so well spec'd, I was like, oh, what's the caveat if it's this cheap and, you know, looks all glossy and whatever. So it was really interesting to spend some time in some of the new generation Havel product, because I haven't really driven the new Great Wall Ute. I didn't really drive the H6 that we had a couple of months ago. So this was my first real steer of a brand new Havel product. And I have to say, I was pleasantly surprised. Now, is it going to be something that I recommend to people first up? Probably not, but definitely something worth looking at because the pricing's so sharp now. And as we've covered quite extensively in the news segments and whatnot on the podcast and in our coverage for however many months, the fact that this is so affordable and in quite ready supply, as far as I know, it could become a really viable option for a lot of small SUV buyers in Australia.
What is the price?
So the Jolion Ultra is, as the top spec, is $30,990 drive away, which is crazy. And this is a vehicle that is probably about the same size as a Nissan Qashqai. So it's on the bigger side of small, and it undercuts most base versions of competitors from both the light and small SUV segments. So I guess when you think about what this car would logically compete against, it's about the same size as like a Kia Seltos, Nissan Qashqai, all that kind of stuff. And those cars all sort of start around the 30 grand mark. The Kia, you can get a base one for about 30 drive away, but everything else is like 30 plus on road costs. And even then, you're also looking at some smaller ones that are a little bit more upmarket, maybe like a Volkswagen T-Cross, a Skoda Kamiq, that kind of thing, which all start again around that 30 grand mark, give or take, before on roads. So it's really well priced. It's got everything that the company can throw at it. It's got huge screens. It's got LED headlights. It's got a full gamut of driver assistance tech, which I'll touch on later. May still require a bit of work, but at least it has it. And, you know, this new platform, which they funnily enough call the Lemon platform, which isn't really it's not the best name you can give to something in automotive, but, you know, it stands for something, and I can't remember it off the top of my head, and I can't be bothered scrolling through words to find it. But it's basically a shrunken version of the H6 platform. And like generally cars in these segments are enlarged versions of, say, light or small hatchbacks, whereas here they've actually shrunken down a larger car. And so it sort of drives with the feeling of being a bit more substantial and a bit more hunkered down. And I did a lot of country driving in this car when I had it, and was actually quite impressed that this cheap and cheerful little, you know, Chinese SUV can actually handle long stints on the freeway with, you know, general refinement in terms of road and wind noise, and also a good degree of comfort in the suspension. It's interesting because, like, I gave it a 7.8, which is, like, you know, a decent score, not blow your socks off, and it's probably not a first choice if I was to start, if someone was asking me what the best small SUV there is. And I think that the spec below, which is called the Lux, at about 27 or 28 drive away, is probably better value and a bit sharper compared to some other cars. But when you think about how much stuff this car packs in, and also the amount of space you have, like I was almost swimming in the back seat when I tried to sit behind my own driving position. And it's got air vents, it's got charging points, it's got leather look trim, it's not real leather, and, you know, it's only really missing inbuilt satellite navigation from the features list. Otherwise, it's pretty well kitted out, and it's pretty convincing as a overall package.
So I've had lots of friends and acquaintances asking me about Havel lately, asking me to give them my thoughts. So I had a chance to drive a Jolion up here in Brisbane. But I'm wondering for you, what are the key reasons why you wouldn't recommend the Jolion for somebody who is looking for a small SUV today?
Well, I have three con dot points in my review, which are probably three main reasons why I may not recommend them to someone. At the moment, it goes without an ANCAP rating. So even though it's fully kitted out with driver assist tech, it's even got a front center airbag, they've done their due diligence and tried to tick all the boxes. At this stage, we can't guarantee that it is a five-star rated car from a safety perspective. So that would be something I would be cautious about. Another thing is the assistance systems, which I touched on earlier. I had a little bit of trouble with the – it has two different adaptive cruise modes. So one is just, you know, your standard adaptive cruise with lane keep assist, and the other one's called like adaptive cruise assist, or it has a funny name in the menu, which is probably a literal translation from Chinese. It was quite temperamental in that as soon as it sees a bend coming up, it would just violently brake the car. And so if I had it set to like 100 or 105 indicated, it would come up to a bend and then just suddenly slam on the brakes and go down to like 95, which I guess is sort of like the predictive navigation based braking you might find in some German like S-classes or whatever, but I feel like it would be a little bit more polished than that. And then also setting the distance to the car in front, for some reason there's only two settings. So normally you get like three or four like line bars between the two little virtual cars in your cluster. And for some reason I could only go between a distance setting of three or four rather than one, two, and three. So it would mean that the distance that it would set was so far ahead that, you know, a car could be well more than that 3 second gap in front of you and it will just start slowing down and then just randomly slow up, speed up, slow down or whatever. And it was just really frustrating. So I tend lately, because most cars with systems like that these days from, you know, from Korea, even Japan, Toyota stuff is really good. And the European stuff, even in my own Golf, which is, you know, a few years old now, I normally can just set that stuff and leave it. Whereas this one, I actually had to turn it off and take over myself. And I know some people will go like, oh, we're first world problems or whatever. But if you're buying a car that has all this tech, you expect it to work correctly. Yeah. And I think it might just need it might be a software update. It might need a recalibration just so it recognizes certain road markings and doesn't just go into emergency mode. Yeah, so that was another thing that bothered me. But otherwise, like the surround cameras are really good and the blind spot monitoring work well. It was just that adaptive cruise system that really pissed me off on a couple of occasions.
I've heard there is a software update coming for that.
Well, that's good to know because I think that would be something that I would be pressuring them to do. The final thing that might be a thing that I would knock it for that perhaps could sway someone away from it is that if you plan on doing extended drives on it, while the platform and the cabin are refined enough to handle it, the driver's seat and the steering wheel lack certain adjustment ways so that you actually can't, if you're like me where you're very long-legged, and I know there's a few people in the team that are all legs and no body, the under thigh support, you can't adjust the angle of the driver's seat cushion, so you can't support your under thigh, and it also is quite short, so your knees and the beginning of your under thigh is like not supported, and so over long journeys you actually get sore legs. And also the steering wheel doesn't adjust for reach, it only adjusts for height, which just screams, I don't know.
Well, that was my big issue with it because I just could not get a comfortable position. The steering wheel was like ages away and the seat, you just couldn't move it around where you needed it to. I just found that really frustrating.
Yeah, Paul is built like a crane or a flamingo. So I can imagine that he would have had the thing all the way back and then the backrest upright and then just standing like full stretched arms. So exactly like Paul and myself are probably longer legged. So it's not supportive and not super comfortable over long journeys. And you sort of have to push yourself up against the steering wheel to make it comfortable. So those would probably be the three main areas that I would say need improvement. But you know, I can understand that some people now, a lot of people just need cars and they're willing to take a punt on a brand that they don't really know. I would argue that it's probably a better resolved vehicle than an MG ZS and ZST. The ZS, I don't even know why someone would buy that, the base one. But the ZST is better, but I just think that this is a more well-rounded vehicle. And the displays and everything are much nicer and it sort of gives off, it's actually cheaper than a top spec ZST as well. So, but it looks like and feels like a more substantial car.
I think it also shows you how much
other manufacturers are kind of ripping us off, because if you can produce a car that has all of those features and is fairly competent and reasonable to drive and to own, it just shows you that we are really kind of being taken to the cleaners by everyone else. I mean, look at the price of that Yaris Cross. I mean, it's a perfect example of just no.
I think what impressed me the most, because I've spent a little bit of time now on a Jolyon and an H6, the infotainment and digital instrument cluster setups in both of them look really, really modern and polished. But that surround view camera that you can get on them, the quality of that is absolutely superb, and that you can have that 3D view that you can rotate around, that's luxury car stuff in something that's 30 grand. And you get in some cars and they can't even get a freaking reversing camera right, and they've been around for years. So Havel's really, really made some strides there.
Yeah, absolutely. Totally agree. On the topic of the screens, the lack of inbuilt navigation on the top spec model might be a sore point for some people. And also, I think that some of the menus and navigating them, and I think Scott Colley found this in his review as well, some things just haven't been converted to our market correctly. Like the heated seats is such a convoluted process, because you have to go into like vehicle settings, comfort settings. And
I actually found out how to do it properly, because I complained about the same thing. You actually swipe the screen, the home screen, to the left. But I tried doing that. You have to swipe it from off the edge of the screen. You can't swipe it from anywhere on the screen.
Why should it be that hard, though?
I know. That's true.
That's already too hard for me, and I hate it. And then also the menu that comes up, if you don't do it the way that Paul said, the seat that you're trying to heat, if you press the one that corresponds with the side that the passenger's on, it's actually heating up the driver's side, because it's obviously been converted from left-hand drive in China.
Oh, God.
So there's that. And then also I just had so much trouble trying to figure out how to use the driver's instrument display, because some ways of navigating it required you to be at a standstill. It took me forever to figure out that if you hold the OK button, then you can access the trip computer. But then if a driver assistance system pings you with a notification, it overrides it and then goes back to the view that it tends to default to in the layout that it had. So it's just not as simple as a lot of stuff that you'll find on the market at the moment. So It's a much better effort from a brand that is clearly gaining traction in our market. And I think, especially with these new products, it certainly deserves to. I've seen a few Jolyons on the road in Melbourne. I've seen a few H6s. And a few of my friends who saw me with the car while I had it were very interested to see what it was and what it was like. So I think it's certainly getting there. And it's probably one of the most convincing vehicles from MG, Havel, GWM, and I think we'll just see this thing a lot more regularly on our roads, especially given there's so much interest about it, because they look so cool.
Certainly. The review and the video is up at the site now if you want to have a look at it. James Wong, thank you.
Thanks, guys.
That's an end to this week's podcast. What cars have we got coming up in the garage next week, Paul?
Well, we've got some interesting stuff. So Kia Sorento PHEV, which will be great. We've got a press conference Q&A for the Eclipse Cross PHEV. So it sounds like it's the month of the PHEV. We're doing a Q&A for the Ineos Grenadier, however you want to pronounce it. So that's coming up as well. We're also driving the Golf GTO, which I'm looking forward to. So it is going to be an interesting week in terms of cars through the Melbourne garage. In Sydney, we've got S4 Audi, a Lexus UX, and then up in Brisbane, Taycan Turbo S and MX5 as well, which should be fun.
Yeah, you say tomato, I say tomato. You say PHEV, I say FEV. So it's very interesting hearing the different ways it's pronounced.
I've never heard you call it PHEV before, Paul.
Yeah. No, I think I've heard Paul say PHEV, but really? I know I always say FEV.
Does anyone Changing call it PHEV?
Oh, that's so clunky. Does. We don't have all day.
Well, if you have any feedback, we're always keen to hear from you. podcast@carexpert.com.au. And don't forget to give us a rating as well on your podcast platforms. Paul Marrick and William Stopford, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mandy.